Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Unemployable Podcast. Today we have a special guest that is driven all the way from Brisbane into the traffic, all the way to the Gold Coast. We've got Tony Williams from Ray White Special Projects. How are you, Tony?
Good, thank you.
Good, good, good. For those of you guys that don't know, Tony is a veteran in the Queensland property development landscape with a career spanning over about 3 decades. Tony and his group specialize in residential development and site sales, including land estates, subdivision, broadacre land, and medium to high density residential. And Shannon and Carson have been using Tony for quite a few years now. They get some inside deals, I think, that I don't get to look at. But yeah, again, glad to have you here. And Carson, Shannon, as usual, thank you very much.
Fabulous, mate. Always good to be here.
Always adding value with what you guys are doing. You guys seem to amaze me every week with some of the deals that these guys are doing. Today, they told me about another one. I get FOMO all the time, and I know at some point I'm going to be able to get involved in one of them with you guys. So we thought it'd be good to get Tony on today. Actually, Tony was on this podcast once before, and we had an amazing podcast, and it got lost. So we all make mistakes, and nobody's perfect, but for some reason, I think it got deleted by accident. And Tony is here again, so really appreciate your time for being here. Let's discuss the landscape and the property development, I guess specifically in Queensland, because that's where we're based. Obviously, that's where you're doing most of your work. What's happening in the landscape out there in the property development space?
Been very aggressive growth in the market over the last sort of 3 or 4 years particularly. So a huge uplift in range of pricing, revenues. Extreme shortage of supply of opportunity and a lot of difficulty in releasing land to the market and actually getting stock on ground to sell to the consumer. So with that limitation on supply, there's been overwhelming demand, prices have gone up. So getting the properties to a stage where you can actually sell them has been enormously challenging. So something like land, flat land, so subdivisional land, it's in terms of if we're looking at a site at the moment and where it's headed to in the market, you're going to have more buyers than you need at the minute. So the competition to secure land is incredible. The constraints that sit over land to actually deliver them to the market are really strong. High risk in terms of planning and cost to produce that land has gone up. Mm-hmm. Ironically, in the built form space, that's been less. There's less ability to bring that on than there has been in previous years just because of construction costs. Mm. So anything in that high density that caters to, quite a sector of the market in the terms of the number of consumers has been really difficult to get out of the ground. So a lot of the groups that would have, could have, should have done that market have moved into land. So that has sort of increased that competition. We're probably best known for land. We do a lot of townhouse, medium density, and then some high density, which we'd like to get into more just because that's the way the market will move over the next 10, 15 years.
Do you feel like this is going to keep continuing this way for quite some time? Because I always hear mixed reviews from different types of people, most of them that don't know what they're talking about, to be honest with you. But what are your thoughts in regards to where this is going to go in the next, say, 5 years?
I can't see that the demand is going to soften, and I can't see that the supply is going to be fixed in terms of bringing on. Even if we're thinking about bringing on more land today, by the time it actually gets into a developable stage, once you've got through the various planning stages, federally, state, the local authorities, you're years down the track. And I'll give you some examples. So something like Ripley, at the Western Corridor, which we got in at a very early stage in the early 2000s, and the council came in and designated all that land for future development and coloured it a nice pretty pink colour. Developers came in, consumed the land, and we sold the first blocks, I think Mark Creevy, my business partner, out there in 2003. And the first Providence, the Shepherd family bought the first land out there. It was something like 10 plus years before they practically delivered a block to the market. Now that was for designated land. So it doesn't matter if you've got the designation in place, it all gets ground down these days. Sewer, water, they're the major issues. And then the constraints like Koala Veg, the EPBC legislation. And if you sit any developer involved in land down and said, if you could wave a magic wand, what would you fix? Sewer, water, EPBC. So they're the major constraints that stop land from being delivered to market. So even if we designate an enormous quantum of land out in the market, you still got to solve sewer, water, koala veg. And that they slow things down enormously.
Why, and I guess maybe Shannon and Carson can answer this question as well. Why is there so much constraint around sewer and water? Is it labor? Is it cost? Is it red tape from local councils or federal government? What is it? Because I look at other countries around the world and how aggressive they are. We'll use Dubai as an example, right? They just throw money at it. They turn a desert into, you know, an island and all these crazy things. And I look at Australia, and we're very good at taking a very, very long time to solve a major problem. Why is that?
I personally, like somewhere like Dubai, like you said, I reckon they run more around the ideology that if you build, they'll come.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of government and incentive. They're actually building it so that it releases land and releases developers. Like we're talking about this the other day, off camera. And it's funny you mentioned Ripley, because that's one of the main areas I've actually seen that done. They went and built the Centenary Motorway and released all that land. And it was probably one of the best infrastructure changes they made in a long time, where government actually put it in and they dedicated the money to go and build that. But they still didn't streamline everything. It still didn't release it all straight away. And the processing behind that, it still didn't bring water, sewer, get rid of EPBC. That was still, what'd you say, a 10-year process.
Yeah.
So most infrastructure is delivered by developers 99% of the time, and that's where the constraint comes, because it could be 2 kilometres down the road and it doesn't want to be the council or government put it back on the developer to bring that in, and the cost of it is so high it doesn't make sense all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's right. I mean, it's exactly what Shan's saying. Like, I mean, Lismore City Council, there was a big development that got approved. And they said, we know we're going to click the ticket on the infrastructure charges at maybe $30,000 a pop. We'll just drag the sewer and water down there because we want to see this happening. Councils don't typically do that. So they don't have that forward vision. I mean, as Tony would know, there's that many emerging communities zone blocks around, and agents flick them to me and say, look, you can subdivide it. I was like, yeah, I'll be backwards in a hole by $1 million the time I drag the sewer and water there. So they're not, yes, rezoning swaths of land is one thing, but you know, like Tony says, that's why you get that creep of the, you know, developing out. But then, like you say, you got the hurdles a lot of the time. You got the koalas and the vegetation you can't clear. And then you might have a block over here that can be cleared. And then, you know, until the values go up where you can drag the sewer past the blocks that might not be able to be developed. That's the challenges and why it's such a low, you know, a slow drag, I suppose, before that all happens.
So how do we solve this problem? Like, do you just see this in the next 5 to 10 years being the same thing? Okay, let's get this big block of land here. Let's get this thing rezoned, and then nobody's going to touch it because it's not feasible to do it. Or they buy a block of land, right, and they got to sit on it for 10 years for the capital appreciation to go up, to then go, you know what, I bought this block of land for $10 million. It's now worth $20 million. There's actually money in it. All right, let's run this sewer and water line now. Is that basically what's happening?
Sorry, didn't see you there. While you're here, actually, we've got a new coaching cohort that just opened up for the Unemployable Property Coaching Program that you get taught on how to become a property developer. One-on-one coaching, bi-monthly coaching, and also events where we get a full coach bus with all the students and go to 6-7 different development sites. When I say development sites, from one lot to 10 lots to 50 lots, you get to see exactly why we buy it, how we buy it, how we fund it, and also how you can do it yourself. The next day, we had an amazing event at the QT Hotel here on the Gold Coast, where we had all of our consultants come in and teach everybody on what they're looking for with sites, what are the different trends, and how you can become a property developer yourself. Now you see me on the video, but who you're gonna be getting coached by is Shannon and Carson. Who's Shannon and Carson? 4 years ago, Carson was cleaning carpets. Shannon was a machine operator. Today, they're doing over $100 million worth of land deals. I know you're listening, and I know you want to take action. And if that's you, click on the link below or go to www.unemployableproperty.com.au and register your interest, and one of our team will reach out to you, and we'll see you on the next bus. Now get out of here.
There's a lack of desire. I think there's a lack of money from a local authority point of view to solve the solutions. And I think they're very well like squeezed for money. So they just don't have the funds to be able to forward supply any of that infrastructure. The state government has probably taken some steps lately at a minor level, you know, to do things like the Residential Activation Fund. So if you've got a property with an approval in place, you can apply to get funding that would bring sewer or water or some infrastructure that releases the land earlier than otherwise. So those sorts of funds, I think, are absolutely perfect. If they were issued on a state level and a federal level, that makes perfect sense to release more money. I can't understand, they're very good at giving benefits to first home buyers, to giving rebates, to giving money to get them into assets. I don't understand why that's sort of treating the symptom as opposed to the issue, the main problem. If they put that money back into infrastructure, Kennett did it down in Victoria years and years ago, when he stepped in, it sold off a lot of the public held assets to private funds to private money to fund infrastructure. And that opened up Melbourne for 15, 20 years, where he had a clear path where the sewer was going. They put the sewer in and then everything followed. So Melbourne had this unbelievable growth that was based around where all that infrastructure was supplied. And I don't understand why some groups, governments haven't followed that blueprint, particularly in areas like SEQ. I mean, you're going to grow, our only areas of growth really are Logan and it has your head west. Yeah, north is sort of kind of captured once you hit the Sunshine Coast. And so it's sort of pretty easy to plan out where the infrastructure is and required. So I don't understand why they haven't made inroads into doing that.
Yeah, and this is the frustrating thing, right? Like every second article is about housing affordability, you know, how we're not going to build enough housing for, you know, the people that are moving here. We've got record, obviously, immigration coming into the country, and we can't really build enough for these people to come and move into. And then they're incentivizing these people and they're incentivizing first-time home buyers and all these people looking to get into the market. And that's all great. But when you're a first-time home buyer and you're going, okay, you know, you get an incentive and it's, you know, no stamp duty, less than 750 grand. Like, where are these people buying? You can't even deliver something for that cost anyways. We were just talking about, you know, off camera on the increase in cost in regards to getting these developments ready for a builder to come on. And they're in the hundreds of thousands of dollars just to get them going. So, I mean, I'm not a rocket scientist, but at the end of the day, if someone like that did that in Melbourne and it worked, why the hell are we not doing that now? And we're just incentivizing someone that isn't going to be able to purchase the thing in the first place because it's not there.
Yeah. The other thing is, like, we got a site at the moment just outside Ipswich. We're just signing a heads of agreement at the moment for 60 days due diligence. I needed 90 and they won't give me 90 days. So we're just rolling the dice at 60. The problem is, so some councils, they own their own sewer and water infrastructure and they can give you all the information. And then you get other places, I think it's Moreton and, you know, Ipswich, you know, your urban utilities and bits and pieces. So you've got to go to them. If you're going to make an application to these guys, so it's cost me, I think it's $9,000 to get them to assess it, to work out this sewer and water capacity. So trying to get, that's why having a good agent on the other side that can actually condition the vendor that, hey, we can pay you the big ticket items if we can solve these issues, because no developer wants to just, you know, if you've got the zoning, that's great. But, you know, if there's no capacity there, you can't develop it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're running through at the moment, trying to work out if there's just sewer and water capacity, because once again, it's zoned, right? It got rezoned with the new planning scheme changes on the 1st of July. But yeah, sewer and water capacity is a logjam. And we're going to be 25 grand in a hole to find these issues out. And it's supposed to be 30, I think it's 20 or 30 statutory days time frame that they are supposed to give this information back to us. Engineers, like, it's taking 90 at the moment. And I've got 60 days due diligence because they wouldn't give me any more. And we're trying to make this thing work. And I've been up front with him. I said, look, I need 90. He's like, well, let's go for 60 and we'll try and get an extension. But so that's the challenges as a developer that we're looking at, especially when you start doing, I mean, that's 350 lots. So it's going to have some impacts, obviously, as opposed to four or five lots where it's probably, you know, going to slide through. So yeah, it's an expensive game. Yeah.
I've been in built form development for quite a few years, and I didn't have a lot of experience in land. Well, I still don't have a lot of experience in cutting up land. I've learned probably more in the last 6 months than I've had ever. And I'm starting to think myself of getting away from built form and going into land just because seeing what Shannon and Carson have been doing. But obviously it makes a lot of sense now why so many people are looking for these infill type of land developments, because it's all good getting your 200, 300 lot subdivision and getting it approved. But if you can't get the water and sewer there, forget about it. So the work obviously is in finding these blocks of land, which Shannon and Carson are absolute experts at doing. What other opportunities? A lot of our viewers are first-time developers learning to get into the land development space, following Shannon and Carson's journey, getting inspired. What are some of the opportunities that you see for them right now in Australia?
It's
specifically Southeast Queensland, I guess.
It's getting harder and harder.
Yeah.
So the barrier to entry into the market is it's a lot higher in terms of buying a development site in today's market. Is a lot more expensive just to acquire the land than what it was 3 years ago. And then you've got a whole bunch of different tiers. So if I'm selling a site and we're up to say 5 mil on the land value, there's a massive group of buyers that are looking to get into the market, anything from $1 to $5 million. Then the buyer levels thin out. So 5 to 10, 10 to 20, above 20, it generally thins out because the equity required to get into these projects is huge. So where you start and how you get to that position, it's just a matter of starting with something that you can manage and then working your way up.
Mm.
So I'd be interested to know Carson and Shannon's view, but assessment of risk and what you get into and what you don't get into, because the assessment of risk is a lot of where the value sits. Mm. So if you want to get into a raw site and create some value by getting approvals or de-risking it to a position where you can actually have a pathway to development, like there's huge uplift at the moment because a lot of people just don't have the skill to do that or the money or the time. So being able to get into something and provide some value, and if you can get some structure in the acquisition, ideal, but then you're going to get push and pull against, you know, guys like me who are trying to run, you know, for the best result for the seller to get competition going, that concertinas, that you know, opportunity to get breathing space to de-risk.
Yeah.
So how do you assess that at the front end and what do you decide to get into? I mean, that's what these guys have been really good at, and getting into the level and build.
Yeah.
And they've just gone up. They're probably, I don't think there's been anything that you would have gotten into that you haven't done really well. So that is a huge skill. If you can replicate that and de-risk and either develop and make good money or sell on and get the uplift based on the de-risking you've done, they're key elements.
You know, it's funny you say that, because as much as Shannon and Carson work in with you and have bought sites off you and probably have given you sites to sell, if not, you know, probably in the future, at the same time, you guys are in competition to each other because they want to be attracting, you know, mom and pa before you do, because at the end of the day, your job is to get the best price for the actual seller. And it's interesting. It's an interesting relationship, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, Shannon and Carson. So I've seen what you guys have been doing and the success that you guys have been having in the land space. And you guys are quite unique in what you guys do. So for any of the first time, you know, developers, what's a couple things that you would tell them to be doing? Like, is it just, you know, get educated? Is it, you know, do the hard yards, send out the letters, knock on the doors? Because we were talking off camera, and what's easy to do is easy not to do. And it's all good to say, yeah, go and make 150 phone calls a day and go and send 100 letters a day and the rest of it. But the reality is you'll do it for one day, you'll do it for 1 week, and then you're going to be like, this is too hard basket. See you later. So what are your kind of...
Well, I'll just
your expertise.
Go back to when I was started. I didn't even know what a DA was, you know, the first time I heard that. So I think there's an education piece of it, whether it's going out and, you know, actually getting formally educated or doing a course of some sort or trying to work for a developer or volunteer time. You've got to understand the game and the lingo to a certain degree. We've said it a few times, go buy an hour of a town planner's time. What you'll get out of that 1 hour of sitting there with a town planner and picking their brain and understanding what you're looking for. So you can say to the planners, look, what if I'm only, if I can only do four lots, or you know, understand what the zoning is. And then the other thing is the term piece, like what Tony was saying, like if you can get the right terms, all of a sudden it's not irrelevant what you can afford, but you can get some incredible uplifts. Like this, we've done very small deals, as you know, four lots where we've got an uplift by having a delayed settlement, and that was enough to get our deposit to actually develop the site before we even settled on it. And then at the other end of the scale, this Rosewood one, you know, it's a $6 million purchase. It'll be worth $20 million if we get that DA approved. And we've got a 15-month put and call option. So we're hoping that it's code accessible to have that approved before we settle. Mm. So getting the right terms, you know, that vendor, they just want the biggest number they can get. And because we're getting those terms, we can give them a pretty decent number if we can, you know, solve the sewer and water capacity, or find out if there is sewer and water capacity. So, yeah. And then building relationships with agents, you know, because at the end of the day, the deal flow is the hardest part. Trying to get, you know, a lot of mum, dad agents, if you can actually get them to bring you deals, because a lot of the time most of them aren't the Tonys of the world, where they'll pick up a site and they've got no idea. They'll ring me up and go, can this site be developed? And I love those phone calls, because then I've got a crack at actually trying to secure that off market before it goes to the market. Whereas Tony, he's educated enough to actually hold a vendor's hand through that that process. So yeah, is there anything else you add to that, Shan?
I was going to add further to both of what you said is the relationship with the agent. And I mean, it took a while before Tony took us seriously, before he realized we were actually doing stuff and probably saved our number. So it does take a while to build that relationship, and being honest as well. Like, I'm sure you deal with people that come along and just slap a number on with DD, and you know every time they're going to get to the end and they haven't done their homework. And I hope by now, with us at least, you know that we're doing our homework. We're not the highest payers, you know that. We like to find sites with problems, but we're always honest about what we're doing. We'll come back with our homework and say, we've found X, Y, Z, these are actual problems for us. We need more time, or we need less money. We need to pay less. And that's where I think the relationship gets built, has actually been honest through the negotiation as well, not just always having that front up.
I agree. I think I wrote that down, the relationship piece, because what I've done since meeting Shannon and Carson, as an example, has been ringing a lot of the agents that I have relationships with and going, hey, if any land of any kind comes across your desk, send it to me. Because the first thing I'm going to do is look at it, and I want to call Carson and Shannon. I'm going to flick it to them and say, hey, have a look. Is there anything in it? And I've been doing this, haven't I, right? I've been doing this over the last month or so, sending a couple. Nothing's come off yet. But again, it's getting those relationships built, in my opinion, is one of the most important things once you start really understanding. Now, I want to dig into, a friend of mine sent me something on Instagram yesterday of a guy that's talking about, you know, the New Zealand property market is shitting itself. The Canadian property market is shitting itself. We're 18 months behind in Australia.
UK is coming down.
Right. Yeah. Right. In Australia, the same thing's going to happen here, because it's all built off this, you know, everyone's got rose colored glasses. It's all based off, you know, migration. Right. And as soon as they stop migration, it's not local demand. It's this kind of fugazi that's being propped up. Do you think the property market is becoming too reliant on interstate migration and overseas buyers, or are we still underestimating the actual local demand? Because it's all good having this interstate migration, and I'm in development as well, and this international migration. But if, for whatever reason, the government turns off the tap or slows it down, do we still have enough local demand that you feel coming from the market for future development?
I do. And it might not be at the pace that we've got now. Mm-hmm. And things might calm down. Rates of sale might calm. Pricing growth might calm. I don't think that's a bad thing, to be honest. I think that gives longevity in the market. Mm-hmm. I think what has happened is, and it'll be interesting over the next couple of years, because a lot of interstate migration has been pushing into SEQ, because areas like SEQ were cheaper than somewhere like Melbourne. So everyone in Melbourne got out of COVID. They said, I hate this place. It's cold. I want to go and live up in Queensland. So huge interstate migration. Then we had, coupled with a lack of supply, a lack of ability to bring on supply, prices go up. So whether the, if that calms down a little bit, I think that just gives us more longevity. But I think that SEQ has got its own critical mass now. Like, it's a big place. It's broad. So I think we're going to have enough to sustain ourselves, if that makes sense. I just think the market is mature enough where it will actually be okay. Having said that, if you go back to something like 07, when I was the greatest agent under the sun, and then the GFC hit, and then suddenly revenue just dropped through the floor. We had hundreds of millions of dollars worth of deals in the pipeline, all gone. So we had to go back. And so sometimes you get hit with something that you just can't see coming. Mm-hmm. So I don't think our market is like that. I think we're mature enough, big enough, and undersupplied enough in terms of land, townhouses, units, that I think we're going to be okay. Oh. And certainly in today, I've got no forward outlook that's going to happen to our market, you know, at all.
Just had the very opposite of that with COVID. Instead of the 07 or 08 going down, we've just had COVID, which no one would have seen, the amount of inflation that we've had, the property rises that we've had. When it first kicked in, we certainly weren't expecting it. We were going, oh, geez, what do we... We had some projects on and sales stopped right before it went crazy. And we're trying to get rid of a couple of projects.
That was an incredible dynamic because the market was staring at each other for a while. And we had a lot of campaigns that we were running on assets at that time that said, hang on, we're just going to wait this out. We don't want to start our campaign. We don't want to put our property on the market until we're comfortable that the market's going to be okay. The ones that we did have on the market, inquiry rates belted it. So, yeah, there were only a handful of opportunities. So everyone went to those opportunities. Ended up getting massive, like, quantum of offers, huge inquiry. So it actually worked in reverse. We didn't know that was going to happen, nor did they. They said, we've got a, you know, desire to sell this now. So a couple of the assets that we did have in the market got huge attention. So it was an interesting time frame.
How are you finding the margin space? I went to a event recently and they're like, oh, some of the big boys are now factoring in future growth into their feasibilities to make them stack up because there's so much competition. And that's one thing that we've always said to our guys is, look, don't be factoring any future growth because who's got a crystal ball? Maybe the big boys can probably, wear that a little bit more than the average punter. Are you seeing that in the marketplace? Or
everyone's buying with escalation at the moment.
Yeah, well,
I would argue that in a FISO, given what we've gone through, it's understandable. But someone, you know, the music stops at some stage, whether it's a slow or whether it grinds or whether it drops. That's when it happens. So if you've caught when your development isn't mature or done, and you've got escalation there that you're relying on, that's when you get squeezed. Margins depends on who you talk to and how they're assessing it. Yeah, you know, they range all over the place. If I sat down in front of 10 development groups and said, what's your margin? They'll talk about IRR. They'll talk about, I want 25%. I don't know if anyone's bought on a genuine 25% unless they've got good terms, in terms of being able to de-risk it. Mm. That's sort of not really a benchmark, I don't think, anymore. And a lot of groups are buying just to control pipeline so that they've got stock to continue work on.
And I guess that's what... I mean, it depends where you are at in your journey. Like a lot of these bigger development companies, right? They have a business that they need to feed. They've got a lot of staff. They've got a lot of overheads. So they have no choice but to probably buy some land that margins are squeezed, not as good. Because at the end of the day, if they make no money on a project, but they can still pay, you know, run at a break even for 2 or 3 years and still pay wages and staff and overheads, that's what they need to do. But for a new developer, right, total different perspective. It's you. Like you look at Shannon and Carson, okay, what's your team? Shannon and Carson, right? They don't have 10 other employees. They got some contractors, they've got consultants that they're using, but at the end of the day, they run very lean. And in my opinion, moving forward, those are the ones that will win. The ones that run things lean, that are very efficient, are the ones that will win. But I agree with escalation, depending on the length of time. Like, no one has a crystal ball, right? But at the end of the day, if you sit there, right, and you go, okay, this is why we do these podcasts, right? You're hearing from Tony Williams, right? The director of Ray White Special Projects, one of the top, you know, sales agencies in this residential development land space in Queensland and probably northern New South Wales, telling you from his mouth what he is seeing, right? This is the research that you're doing. You got to listen to these guys because they're the ones that are on the ground telling you. Like I read something here that you said, where was it? Before the subdivision market, is the strongest that you've seen it in about 15 years. You must have said that somewhere, right? Good old ChatGPT brought this up for me. So when you start seeing this information and listening to this information, it's basic supply and demand, right? You can make your own assumptions, but if you look at the short term, don't look at it a 5 to 10 year horizon, but if you got a project that you're working on and it's a 12, 18 month, 24 month subdivision, as an example, whether it's 1 into 2, 2 into 4, or, you know, a block of 10, in my opinion, when you look at basic supply and demand, I can't see it in the short term going the other way. Now, can we have a world war? Can we have all these things that can happen? Of course, but we've been talking about World War III for years and years and years, and you can scare yourself out of investment. It doesn't matter what you're investing in. But again, it's doing the due diligence and doing the research so you can get an understanding. So these guys, like you just heard it from Tony, he doesn't think many people are buying off feasibilities that are showing 25%, right? Unless you're buying really well, or you're inflating the numbers a little bit, going, okay, well, if the last 12 months land went up by X, let's say even at 50% or 40% or 60% of that, it'll go up by X. And these are the scenarios that people need to start calculating in my opinion, in the short time frame. I know Shannon and Carson are extremely conservative and they will not do that. And that's fine, but I think there will probably be a point in time where most people probably have to do that, or else you're not going to be buying the land because you're going to get outbid by someone else, because the whole supply and demand piece is just going to keep lacking, in my opinion. If you're telling us you can't get land because we can't get sewer and water to it, it doesn't matter because it's not going to be taking the market in today, right? We need it today, not in 10 years' time.
Well, that's why we buy problems, because we want the margins. And so if you can get really good at solving a particular problem, Tony mentioned EPPC, we've made my first project, I think it's because of naive, we cleared trees in a heritage listed rainforest in Springbrook. I got really quick on understanding what you can and can't do. So that's where we've really niched into, you know, flood affected sites, you know, ecological problems. Shannon's got a civil construction background, so it makes sense. Let's find sites where we've got major bulk earthworks. We've got a site where we're importing 80,000 cube at the moment, whereas most developers just freak out at the thought of that. Or we've got another one that we bought in Coomera. It's got a lot of slope on it. So if you can find those problems, a lot of people just put it in the too hard basket, and that's where you're going to get in the margin. So as long as you can quantify what that risk is, it's just a line item in your feasibility at the end of the day. And a lot of people just freak out, oh, it's got bushfire, or it's got, you know, landslip hazards. Can the problem be resolved? If the answer is yes, awesome, there's the opportunity. So you can cook the books very quickly as well. I mean, I'm sure retaining walls has crucified plenty of developers along the way, but that's why we do it that way. The question for you, Tony, with the, you mentioned you got like the big end of town and then we got the mum dads, is there a sweet spot? You said from 1 million to 5 million, there's a lot of competition there. I don't know if it's a price point or a per lot basis, where I know a lot of some of the big boys are like, I don't want to do anything under 50 lots, for example, and then you got the mum dads tap out, you know, at a certain level. Is there a sweet spot in the middle that you find that this was where me and Shan prefer to play? But do you have an opinion on where that is, where there's a gap in the market that the big guys don't really want to play in, or are they going everywhere now?
There probably used to be.
Yeah.
In terms of probably that 10 to 20 spot, that's been consumed.
Yeah.
And the big guys, as we say, are dropping their sites in terms of, because you can't wait around for the 1,000 lot subdivision to come on. Mm. It doesn't exist. Mm. Yeah, there might be 5. Everyone knows where they are. Mm. So you can't wait for those to happen or become available or negotiate or build a relationship to buy them. So everyone's pushing down and everyone's pushing up. And what's happening at the moment is a lot of, you know, private high net worth type of groups that probably don't have experience in development teaming up with smaller developers to lift their game. So that gap really doesn't exist anymore. So, and there's groups around that might be a 2 or 3 man band, private groups that had traditionally been up to 10 mil that are now 10 times that if they want, because they've got a money person with a desire to park their money in a higher returning environment. And they've got a couple of people, 2 or 3 people, got a desire to swim in a bigger market and have got the skill to pull that off. So that gap is kind of, and you're getting positions from groups at levels where you're going, wow, I didn't think that they could perform at that. And you dig into it a little bit and you find out, no, we can do this. So the gap used to exist. I reckon it's expired now. It just, everyone can do everything. And you can't, from our position, it's just a qualification of, okay, well, we know you can do it, but where's your money coming from? And the private debt flowing into the market's huge. So not hard to get.
And I think there's a massive demand as well from that gap in regards to builders, right? Like I know these boys are talking to a fair few different builders and their phones are ringing off the hook, right? Because they've got the land, builders need the land. What we have to remember is there are some developer builders and there's others that are just builders, right? That wait for the developers to come and bring the land. But I think what's happening now is you're starting to get these builders going, holy shit, you know, land's drying up. I got to start looking for it because again, I've got the estimator, I've got my receptionist, I've got all these people that work for me and they need the work. And I'm seeing it with Shannon and Carson now and the attraction that they're getting from these types of businesses, right? These types of companies that are going and saying, hey, I'll offer you this, I'll offer you that. In my opinion, that's an opportunity, right? If you can solve the problem and go out and do the work and find these, like I thought they'd only take 50 lots or 100 lots. They were talking about taking, I'll take 5, I'll take 10, right? They'll take anything that can actually get, that they can actually convert into a margin. So in my opinion, there's a massive opportunity just in that and targeting those, right? You don't even need to go to the agents as an example. I'm not trying to cut you out of the deal, Tony, right? But the reality is there's that much demand from these builders that if I were to ring 5 of them tomorrow and say, hey, I've got a lot, you know, I've got a subdivision of 10 lots, I could get 5 of them fighting over it, giving me the best
price. No problem.
No problem.
No
right?
problem.
Which is an interesting situation. And you mentioned another thing about funding and these high net worths coming in and institutional money. I'm starting to see the likes of, and all of us would be like Mosaic as an example, Greya, these types of developers, Sherpa Property Group that are now coming out of the woodwork, right? And keep on building and building and building. And you're going, how are these guys doing it? They're not doing it just from the margin and the profit that they're making in these projects. It's I know this, you know, game from the back end, but they must be, in my opinion, getting funding from somewhere, whether that's through superannuation companies or high net worth companies to make things work, because they're just continuing to buy and build and buy and build and buy and build. And that's another strategy, right? Like I know now with Shannon and Carson, and they haven't been doing this for 8 years, 10 years. You know, they've been doing this seriously for the last four and a half years, right? So it's not like they're seasoned veterans, but let me tell you, in the last four and a half years, the amount of attention these guys are gathering, there'll be people throwing money at them.
Yeah.
It's like me. I'm like, hey, if anything comes up, let me know. Please let me know. And I know there will be a point in time. But the thing is, I know they've got 10 other people that were in line before me doing the same thing because of their relationships before. So in my opinion is find out, right, how you can start learning how to do these subdivisions. Talk to the Tonys of the world. Talk to the Shannons of the world. That's why we have a free Facebook group called Unemployable Property on Facebook. Go in. Join the group. You'll be asked a few questions and there's so, it blows me away the quality of people that are in there and the things that they're posting. Unbelievable. And there's, in my opinion, is looking for high net worth. So once you start looking for the deals, if you don't have the money, there's plenty of money out there.
It's a great synergy between it too. And that high net worth and the private funding that comes into those projects, they'll back the jockey. So they'll look at the group. If you look at Mosaic, if you look at Grayer, you look at Sherpa, they're not yesterday, today people. No. They've been around for a while. They've built integrity into their brand and built it up.
Correct.
And do brilliant developments.
Unbelievable developments.
So the money will follow the jockey, the developer.
Yeah.
So if you build integrity into your brand, into yourself, they'll find you.
Another question I have is, I talked to Evaluer not long ago about land subs and build form and stuff. And he reckons about 75% of the deals that he's looking at are being funded by private funding, not the big four banks.
Yep.
What are you seeing in the stuff that you guys are selling? Are you seeing that same kind of thing?
Very much so. Like absolutely. The bank funding, and I think the bank have kind of moved away from that. And so the space has been filled with private funding, and the money that comes into those funders at the moment, there's big pressure to push the money out the door. Mm. So rates are coming down, and most of them are from a property background. So they get it. You know, they get unit development, they get townhouses, they get land. And so the speed of being able to say, okay, Carson and Shannon will give you this, is a lot faster than going through a process at a bank that turn you inside out. Yeah, their time frames are probably narrower. They're, you know, costable.
Yeah.
But that's a cost of doing business. It's like any, like you said before, Shannon, it's just a line item that you've got in your FISO. And if you can get it quickly and there's greater confidence that you'll get it and what you need, the developers have taken that path enormously over the last 5 years. And the banks, I think, have stepped away from it a bit. So that's prolific at the moment. It's just where, and I can't see that slowing.
Yeah, it's such a fast growing market, and it's a market that's been there for quite some time. But I think in the past it had the stigma of, you know, loan sharks and these types of things. But it's this market where you can get, you know, half decent finance on half decent terms, because there's more money out there that can be placed, in my opinion. I know you guys have went down this road quite a bit as well.
Yeah, like we one of my first subdivisions that me and Shannon did together, we bought it off a guy that was getting wrapped up by private money. So I was just like, I'm never using private money. You know, this is a bunch of sharks. And, you know, over time I saw people using it and wrap my head around it a little bit more. And we're big advocates for it in the right deal and in the right terms, because your time frames that you might only have 12 months or 24 months to execute that project, which probably brings me to a question I've got for you, Tony. Like, I know you guys do a lot of mortgagee sales. Where does it go wrong for developers? And I know time frames, people always underestimate how long it takes to do something, and that's can crucify a lot of people, or maybe they just don't assess the risk. Like, what do the good developers do right? And where, when things go south, is there typically one or two things where it goes wrong, or what do you see?
It could be one of 10 things, to be fair.
Yeah.
And that's all the risk assessment up front, right? And that's how you separate someone that does their homework to perhaps someone that doesn't, to someone that just gets bad luck. And particularly with land, if you get your timing out a little bit, if we're talking about funding terms that are 24 months, 36 months tops, it doesn't take much to blow that time frame out. The other thing is cost. You know, cost to deliver. And I mean, if you were going back 3 years and we were talking, if you'd said, Tony, how much does it cost to get a block out of the ground? I go, well, all done, all serviced, ready for sale, 100, 110, 4 years ago. Today, phone up, I'm going, that's like 160, 180. So if your time frame blows out and your costs blow out, that's a lot per block that you're losing off, that's just taken off the table through no fault of your own. And you can just get caught with planning outcomes. You can get caught with, you know, the NIMBYs. Yeah, it can hold you up. Anything like that, you can get blown out. Debt too. Debt. Not having your debt right and understanding your debt, that's a big issue. And particularly with the private funding, where you've got, like I said, 24, 36 tops, you've got to roll in and out, and that's expensive. So replacing the debt is expensive. So that chews, you know, the good developers manage that very, very carefully and are all over it, and generally have a great relationship and communicate with their funder really well.
Yeah, you mentioned the NIMBYs, poor buggers, Clarence Property Group down in Brunswick. You know, they literally got a tent set up there, and, you know, with all their handing out the brochures, and it's been a cleared block for a long time. And we've got friends that live in the area, and it's been slashed, and all of a sudden, you know, it's zoned right, and the poor buggers have, you know, they're puncturing the tires of the, you know, surveyors and slashers that are rocking up on site, and you know, like I said, that's getting held up for no fault of their own.
It's out of whack.
Yeah,
that stuff's totally out of whack. Yeah, in terms of having designated approved land in a housing supply like shortage drama, not being able to produce those houses because someone sits on site and says, I don't like what you're doing there, even though you've jumped through all the hoops. It's just, I don't understand that. I just don't get it.
Madness.
Welcome to Australia.
The other one I was going to pull out is wet weather, and it's impeccable timing because we're doing it ourselves right now. So we're 55 days of delayed time because of wet weather just in this project we're in now. So
how much is 55 days in cost that you think that you've blown?
I don't want to think about it.
are we talking like
a couple hundred? Yeah, probably 2 to 3 at the moment.
Yeah, the reason why I'm asking is because like 200,000 or 300,000, right? We're not talking 20,000, 30,000 that you can absorb. And that's why you got to have these contingencies in there and be conservative at the same time, right? Because these things can happen. And next thing you know, you can't do anything about that, right? If there's 55 days of rain, it is what it is.
A plan B, an exit strategy if you have to get out.
Yeah.
Like, how are you going to do that? It's really important.
Yeah.
Like you said before, being conservative, we've been conservative with our construction program. So we've still got plenty of time in there, and that's for our funding and for our construction time. So we're covered on that front. I just like to be a lot more productive than what we've been at the moment, which is not very good.
But what I want to know is, you mentioned, Tony, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, right, 110,000, give or take, cutting a block. And this is very round numbers, right? And now you're saying 160 to 180, give or take, for the same thing. Where is that extra $50,000 to $70,000? Where does that actually go to? Like, this is what I have. It's hard for me to understand that, right? Like, when you're going, okay, well, like, is how much more has the hourly rate went up for the excavator? How much more is the fuel? How much more is it the approvals? Is it, I mean, the interest is the interest, right? Interest isn't that much more than what it was. It was 4 or 5 years ago, but even that component taken out of it, where are these costs coming up to? The reason why I'm asking is, I think there's literally out there right now what is happening in, I'm doing a couple of developments at the moment. One of them is a luxury build, and we're getting a few different quotes from multiple trades over time. And I'm talking, there's 50, 60% difference from quote to quote, like not within 10%. Like, I'm talking cost blowout, like ridiculous amount, to the point where I'm like, have you guys missed something? Have you overquoted? What is it? And I think that there's a lot of people just taking the piss, in my opinion. Do you feel like that's what's happening? Like, where does that extra 60, 70 grand go to? Who is it going to?
I think you touched on a few items there. Like, we forget on the raw costs. Like, once upon a time, we were paying $1, $1.10 for fuel, and for earth moving equipment, you take away the fuel excise because it's off-road tax, and your fuel's costing you 70, 80 cents per litre. Now we're closer to $2. I mean, what's it cost now to bring a container of materials across?
Yeah.
Doors.
Yeah.
Everything has gone up, and it's also supporting that minimum housing cost that you were talking about before. Like, the minimum cost to develop a piece of dirt and to build a house is now higher than what we're used to. I don't think it'll come down.
But what's your
never comes
today?
Down. It'll stabilize and sit at a level, give or take, but it doesn't come back as far as I've experienced. It's just a new norm. And there's always something, whether it's supply chains, whether it's material, whether it's labor, whether it's fuel, it's always something. And if something drops down, the other one lifts up. So it's getting that cost piece. Mm. If we're selling something at the moment, two items that are looked at most, like, in great detail. One is planning pathways, and the second is delivery cost. And whether that's construction, whether it's civil construction, or whether it's building townhouses, units, whatever, that's where the focus is, because that's where the risk sits at the moment. And everyone's had a bit of burning over the last few years. Great revenue growth to somewhat offset it, but still doesn't save you. If your cost blowouts are, you know, are bad, it can really ruin a development. And you're doing it for the fun of it, or worse.
Yeah, those, like you said, those escalations in the back end has saved a lot of developers, but the guys that pre-sold, especially off the plan high rise, they're the ones that really got stuck. And I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of developers that are pulling sunset clauses just because they're having a laugh and they want to, you know, get those extra revenues in their back pocket and doing some dodgy stuff. We've had sites come to us that we've refused to pick up just because they don't want the bad PR of managing all that, and said, "Oh, how about you just take it and then, you know, pull the sunset clause?" And I'm like, "Nah, we don't want to do that, thanks." But then there's also genuine ones where the margins don't stack up anymore. They can't get the 20% margin that they need, and they can't get the bank funding. So it's not always the big bad developer trying to line their pockets. Sometimes it's legitimately the project doesn't stack and they can't go forward.
Yeah, in my experience, it rarely is the big bad developer. Yeah, they're just caught in a position where they're not making money or they're losing money. Who goes into a project to do that? No one does.
No one.
Are you going to pull the trigger on something and lose your car, your house, everything else just to get it done? Mm-hmm. It kind of makes sense, but there's obviously ways to handle it and there are ways not to handle it. And sort of engagement with your consumers is pretty important. Mm. And yeah, there's been a lot of groups that have gone to the buyers and said, "Hey, listen, we're stuck here. We can't deliver this. We know you want it, but we're going to look at this much in terms of an increase on what you paid." Mm. And 8 times out of 10, they go, "I get it. Okay. We want the place. We get it. We've got an uplift in revenue and everything else."
Mm. One thing that fascinates me, especially probably the bigger end of town that you deal with than the standard small little project, is I know some of the bigger groups are really good, and we're trying to learn as much as we can off these guys on some of the creative strategies to get into projects, like some of the negotiation things that I'm even hearing about recently on how they structure deals and how they, you know, might release parts of a deposit over time to, you know, but then to get a longer settlement. Is there anything that you would surprise that, you know, a deal was put together outside of the ordinary? Obviously, you've got options is one thing, but are there any other strategies that you've seen work quite well that some of the groups do that others don't to get something over the line?
Firstly, it depends on your vendor and what they will and won't do. Yeah. And some are quite happy at the moment to go, "Okay, well, I'm in no urgency. I've owned this property forever. I can do something over a period of time." So then it's figuring out what the time is. Mm-hmm. Then it's figuring out, if I was buying it, how much do I have to commit to this project and how do I push that down the road, you know, in terms of trying to balloon it at the back end. Now, you've got agents like me that'll push against something like that. Mm. Dependent upon the proponent, release deposit stage payments are pretty common at the moment. So you go into a project, say, "All right, once I'm unconditional, I'll release deposit." And they go, "Okay." And then it's just figuring out what you can stage it, which kind of pushes it closer to, for instance, a DA, yeah, getting a DA. And then by the time you're sort of getting your second or third payment down the road, you've got it significantly de-risked. Easier to fund, easier to develop, easier to understand. Time. It's just time and release, mm-hmm, more often than not. In terms of strategies, depends on who you're buying from. Some of the public companies, for instance, you know, they can look at doing a paper settlement at a certain period of time, but the practical settlement occurs 11 months later. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of getting title, and they take their security on the way through, which makes sense. Mm. But yeah, some of the public companies, they want to get rid of stock before the end of the financial year, can contract with it at a point in time, but actually not pay for it for 12 months because they've booked the settlement and booked that number, which goes into there.
As an agent, I'm always thinking about the agent as well, because typically if you can't get long settlements, maybe not yourself, Tony, but a lot of agents, they want to get paid tomorrow as well. So you've got to be thinking about that as a developer, because a lot of agents that aren't experienced in the development space, they could just kill your deal on a long settlement just because they want their commission up front as well. So sometimes releasing that deposit and a portion or all of it or some of it goes towards the agent to keep them happy, so then you can get a result that works for the vendor and yourself as well. You've got to be thinking about all parties, and the agent is a part of that as well. So actually thinking about their needs and you know, to get what you want, you got to try and make sure everyone's happy along the way, I suppose.
It's just those questions on the way through, isn't it? If you've got an agent that sort of won't do you any favors because they're not going to get paid for 12 months, then it's unlikely they're going to want to push your barrow. Mm. So understanding who it is.
Yeah.
We've been doing this for 25 years. So it just where it falls for us. We're not sort of stressed about that. We've got deals that are, 5 to 8 years in our pipeline, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's just how it rolls out. But you're right. It's just sort of the stakeholders involved in a process and what they're after and being conscious of it, I think can get you a deal or it can get you the next deal. So it's just that relationship piece.
I'm fascinated to pick your brain as well. Also, remember, we were taking a site to market with you guys and we were having this discussion about how do we take it to market? Obviously, you've got auction, you've got expression of interest campaign, you can put a price on it. What suits what property? I mean, because I was having the argument like, I just want the certainty, maybe we'll go to auction. And then you guys were like, well, let's do the EOI, because with an auction, if you've got only two bidders and one's at 4 and one might see 5, if it's an auction, your highest bid is only going to pay 4 million and 50, whereas they don't know where the other person's coming in. So it actually can potentially work in your favor. The EOI also gives them, they can have a few more terms of due diligence and bits and pieces. Do you just take the ones that need a sale at any price or that have got a lot more certainty to deliver the auction? What's the strategy that goes into your recommendation about how you actually market?
It's probably the moving parts to do with the development. For instance, if we think that the buyers are going to be within a band, a narrow band, and it suits the seller, and it is largely it's about what suits the seller and what the seller wants as an outcome. But you'd auction something if you see it within a narrow band and the buyer is going to be close-ish together. But more often than not with land, it's so subjective. Cost in this, moving parts, from your revenues to your delivery costs to your time frames to your debt levels, all those things put in plus motivation, plus requirement for pipeline, to fill pipeline, there's 20 moving parts. So if you've got something that you can see there are quite big variances on those moving parts, the price differential can be enormous, like hundreds of percent out from the lowest buyer to the strongest buyer. So it's kind of catering for that outcome. And then obviously making sure that you've got groups that will come to the table. And we're sort of wrong as often as we are right with pricing things, because the market may see something that they allows them to pay more. They might see a risk that's amplified that we don't necessarily identify. So it's so subjective. And it depends on who's motivated on that day as well. Who's looking around for stock at that period of time. The builder, exactly like we were saying before, you've got a builder that needs the project to feed the 25 people that work for them. And if they don't have somewhere to move their teams to, they're out.
And that's where timing and luck, in my opinion, plays a role in this, right? But at the end of the day, you just got to be in the game. Because if you're not in the game, then you don't have that stock to give that builder at that point in time. But there are people that are going to be overpaying for things every day. There's someone right now overpaying for a site, overpaying for a house for whatever reason. And you mentioned it before with the vendors, is every vendor has a different problem that they're trying to solve for themselves. They have a different need, right? And then when you were saying about Carson, which you're becoming an expert at, is how are these big guys organizing, structuring these deals? I don't think it's going to be any different than what you guys are already doing now. Cause I've been seeing some of the deals that these guys have structured. I'm like, how do you even do that? Right? How are people accepting these types of deals? But again, it's really understanding who that person is, what type of person that you're dealing with and what are their need, because you might be stuck on a price. If you're stuck on a price, but they're willing to give you a 2-year settlement, not a 12-month settlement, how much more are you willing to pay, right? What is that year of interest and costs and holding costs and the rest of it worth to you? And that could be the difference of going, you know what, I'll give you an extra $100,000 right now for them saying, you know what, yeah, I won the game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They could be an egotistical vendor and go, you know what, no, screw you. You've won the game. But in the back of your mind, you're like, no. I've won the game, but let them feel like they've won. You know what I mean? It's all boils down to negotiation.
And we would have had this conversation, I'm certain of it, during a process of selling something where you've put forward an offer that has terms involved in it. And we've said, okay, you've got a headline figure based on your terms. Tell me what you pay cash. And then it's demonstrating the uplift from what you'll pay today's money to what you'll pay on terms. And you put that in front of an owner, and sometimes it's quite compelling. And they think, okay, well, then they think, who's behind the offer? And if you can explain that, what deals have you done with them? You can explain that. Are they good guys? Yes, they are. And so you can go on that journey. And if their motivation is to look at something with terms because they're confident of that journey and that they'll get that stronger price, it's compelling. As opposed to sort of saying, well, there's your cash offer. You can get out of here in 60 days. But if you want to stick around and work on the journey, we can get you an uplift.
Yeah. Sometimes we make both offers. Like literally, here's the cash offer, you know. And sometimes I make a ridiculously long settlement. It's like they do it in sales all the time. It's like, and the offer in the middle is the one you want them to take. You give them the, you know, the long-winded one that they're never going to take, the cash one, and then the one that you actually want with the bidder terms. And you know, all of a sudden they can get their head around. But Tony, you made the right point. Most people don't take the time to actually understand what the vendor wants, and it's not always money. Sometimes they're selling for need, and if you can release 50 grand or 100 grand or 200 grand to them to solve that need right now, all of a sudden they can wait 6-12 months, you know. So taking the time to actually understand what the vendor wants, and if you can structure a deal where they get what they want, typically you can get what you want as well. But a lot of people just think it's like, you know, puff their chest out, I've got the big fat checkbook, you know, and wonder why they've missed out on the deal still.
Yeah, it's asking that and getting an understanding of what the vendor's requirements, communicating that to somebody who wants to buy it. It's pretty important, you know, in terms of saying, well, the owner will consider this, because that'll shape how you offer and that'll shape your number. So, and sort of, we try to understand from the groups that we work for, the vendors that we work for, what are the bookends, you know, internally, what would you consider? I mean, everyone knows what they would ideally want in a perfect world, someone to pay full price, I get my money in 60 days and I'm out. And the reality is that you've got to understand what. Will you look at a longer settlement time frame? Do you want a release deposit? You have to ask those questions up front. So when you guys phone, I can go, well, this is the dialogue we've had.
Yeah.
Sometimes it turns out differently, but understanding that's pretty important.
What's the other side of a good offer? So what are the bad offers that come in?
Unqualified.
And the bad plays that you see people do.
So unqualified. Big fat figure.
Yep.
From a group that haven't done the work. And you'll spend, as an agent, you'll spend weeks unwinding that position. If it's an unqualified position where they just go in and say, okay, well, here's a nice property. I've done no work on it, but I'll give you this number and I need some DD, you know, 60 or 90 days DD. And you sit there and go, this DD is never going to happen because they're going to find out. Like if I'm selling a site, you guys will tell me what the issues are from start to finish and what the costs are. And generally the feedback you get is pretty uniformed. So if you get somebody who's got a conditional position, that's a really high number, and you know you haven't had any discussions with them through a process, you're going to go, this is not going to happen. But then you've got a seller, quite rightly, that looks at the number and goes, well, I'll roll the dice.
Yeah.
You know, for that sort of money, I'll roll the dice. And you go, you're going to be here in 60 days having a discussion around a new price, or going to go back to Carson and Shannon and go, hey guys, you're still interested in buying that? And you can say, well, Tony, I am, but it's a different world. Yeah, so it's a hard conversation.
We've had a couple of times now on a couple of different projects where it's the buyer on the other end has tried to use DD to soften you.
Yeah.
So they just use it for time, use their 60 or 90 days. They get to the last week and they're like, ah, the comparable sales aren't that great. We now need it for a lot less.
Yeah. Okay. And sometimes you've got no choice to go on that journey, and you do roll the dice. And we've had it turn out that people have bought stuff, but as a percentage play, not often.
You got to, once again, as a developer coming in, you can lose credibility pretty quickly. If you get the reputation that you pull out on the last day of due diligence and, you know, Tony, when he's got two offers side by side the next time around, and that's happened a few times, you're going to be like, hey guys, you know, go with this group instead. Because like when we've pulled out a due diligence, we try and do it in the first week or two and just put so scorers, you know, we had to spend money to find this out. We're not waiting till the last day. There's nothing that does my head in. Like there's groups that me and Shannon just won't sell to anymore because we know that they do that. And it was just, and it's frustrating. And I'm sure you've had plenty of examples of
that. Yeah, I mean, that sort of stuff. I mean, we've had public companies where they've gone into DD and we know they've spent hundreds to get into a position to put forward an offer, but the offer hasn't been conveyed up the ladder. And so they go to get board approval and the board are going, what? No, we're not going to buy this. And so you kind of, it rips the heart out of the acquisition team because they're just not supported by So if some of those teams, and to your point, Carson, if there's a couple of public companies that we would go, well, we would like a letter of evidence to transact from your CEO or your board. Because if I'm selling something for a vendor and I know that that has happened in the past, that's what you're buying in an agent. You're buying some experience in terms of how to handle those situations. Mm-hmm. Doesn't always work out, but and you're right. If someone continually drops out of DD, I'm sitting in front of a seller and going, this happened to us 3 times.
Mm. And to your point, that's where our advantage is. And I say to a lot of the guys we're coaching, it's like one of the advantages we have in the market as the small guy is that you can make decisions really quickly. I can see a site and make an offer on it that day. Whereas some of the bigger boys, you know, they've got to have 12 different meetings and, you know, it goes around in circles for weeks and if not months at a time. So that is a competitive advantage that, you know, a mum, dad developer has, is that if you can assess the risk pretty quick and you've got a good little core team of planner and engineer or ecologist or whatever you have, we can get them in a room pretty quickly or out to site. That's where we can win, where the big guys fluff around forever. So
being light on your feet. Absolutely. Make the decisions. Yeah.
What do you wish more people understood about the property development game before jumping in your experience?
Risk and reward. Yeah. In terms of how, like, we get asked, we've been doing this for a long time. We get asked every single week, why don't you do development? And the answer is it's really hard. Like it's profitable and you do really well, but just assessing that risk piece and having an understanding of the moving parts that can go wrong, funding, planning, you know, services, all that sort of stuff. So at least have a high level. And it's in terms of a good consultancy team. I'd love to hear your guys' view on a good consultancy team. They're worth their weight in gold. And having good relationships with those, engineers, town planners, geotech, all those groups, so important in development. Small or big. Planner and engineer is where it starts with, I reckon. They're awesome. Like awesome in terms of adding value.
100%.
It goes to show you, like, you got guys like Shannon and Carson that have been absolutely killing it over the last 4 years and will continue to do so. You got the likes of, like we talked about them before, Mosaic, you know, Greya, Sherpa. Meanwhile, you have all these other ones going broke and going bankrupt. But then you have these other ones that just keep succeeding and buying more and doing more. Like, in my opinion, there's a skill level there that you're paying for. You know, like, you're an expert in that industry. You're an expert in what you're doing. And other people, I think, are not so good. Right. And these are the ones that probably go in with the rose colored glasses thinking, okay, you know, let me put this on a spreadsheet. Let me put this in a FISO. And they're using the wrong numbers and talking to the wrong people. And then all of a sudden they get caught out. And you said something earlier before, and I always use the same thing. Whereas you have to have your plan A, plan B, plan C, what happens. And I know I hear Shannon talk about this all the time. And again, if it's a development site and you're buying up a block of land and it's raw land, you know, you got to be able to go, okay, what happens if you don't get the DA?
Yeah.
Right. What is your backup? Right. Like, I just bought a block as an example. It's got 4 units on it. We're demolishing it and we're going to build multiple dwellings on it. Now, I know worst case scenario, if something happens within the next 6 months before I demolish the thing, I can rent it out. I know exactly what I'll be bleeding on it. And I already had that calculated going, you know, I can actually cop that for X amount of years on holding that cost rather than just going, let's just demolish it now and get excited. And then all of a sudden go, actually, you know what? The build cost is a lot more than what I thought. And all of a sudden you're sitting there with a vacant block of land that just the land tax is costing you $40,000 a year as an example, right? Like that's not having a plan B or having a plan C. Mm-hmm. So I think that what you said there is risk, right? And there's a risk in regards to the financial risk, but obviously the plan A, plan B, plan C, very, very important, because I've had to use that in the past. I'm sure Shannon and Carson have had to use that in the past at the same time. And what you don't want to do is get yourself in a position where you're the one fire selling something because, you know, one of your partners had to pull out because got divorced or whatever that may be, because these are all things that can happen.
Yeah.
Like Shannon and Carson are in business together. They've got, you know, a lot of debt. They've got a lot of asset, right? But all of a sudden there's a spanner in the works and Carson decides, I don't want to be here anymore. I'm moving to Mexico. What happens, right? That's different level of risk. Mm-hmm. So another thing you got to think about is when you are getting into business and you are doing JVs and you're bringing in cash partners, money partners, is really, really setting those expectations up front, having those difficult conversations and investing in agreements and these types of things, because it's very, very important that it's very, very important. And there's a high likeliness that it can go the other way when there's multiple people involved in a deal. And you would have seen this over and over and over again, right? For me, my number one value, right? One of my number one values is relationship, right? And my relationship with the people that I do business with is very, very important to me. So setting those expectations up front is very important. We did the same thing with Shannon and Carson, like making sure, hey guys, this is what we're doing. Are we going to continue to do this? Are you happy to do this? You know, this is what it's going to look like. This is what it's going to entail. And making sure that we're aligned. Where have you seen misalignment? You would have seen probably a lot of misalignment, to be honest with you, but what's some recommendations that you would give? And again, some of these people that watch this podcast is the Shannon and Carsons 4 years ago that are in their job looking at Shannon and Carson and going, I want to be like them. But Shannon and Carson didn't start with a 50 lot or 100 lot. They started with one. Then they started with two.
The alignment and strategy. First of all, you've got to be in alignment with your partner, right? That might be a different skill set. It might be the same skill set. It might be something that you develop into, or I'll take care of planning, you take care of civils. That kind of, and having alignment and understanding of who's doing what, and then having a goal on what you're doing for every project. And these guys are really good at that. You know, they're aligned. So if you're talking to Carson, you're going to get the same response if you talk to Shannon. So in terms of the way that they buy, in terms of the structure under which they buy and the risk that they will take on, I'll guarantee you across every project, they're aligned. So making sure that you can trust the person you're with, you're aligned in what your strategy is, and your execution, you've got a skill set that can cover it. And that you often see mistakes where someone's carrying more of the load than the next person. And there's a misalignment in terms of hours that you're putting, sheer work volumes that you're putting in, and someone's carrying a project. I mean, my business has three business partners. Mark Creevy, I've been in business with Mark sort of 20 plus years. And Matt Fritche, who's been, you know, I've been in business with for a dozen plus years. And we're completely aligned in what we think about, what we're trying to do with the business. Every conversation that we have within the business, we've got agreement on before we do anything. And we all play a long game. So we're not here for make money, try and screw someone in the short term. And a lot of the competitors that we've had have tried to look at that short-term position and make decisions based on that. And they get squeezed out of the market.
The thing is short-term because they're thinking of the money, because it's such a lucrative game, right? Like that land space that you guys are in, like some of the deals that you guys are doing off camera, like we're talking there, you know, multi, you know, decamillions, nine figure types of deals, like commission structures and these things will change people's lives. And what happens is it's very easy for people just to look at the money going, oh, I'm going to do that. That's my $1 million payout or my $10 million payout. But again, I agree with you so much, because anything that I've been involved in, even with Unemployed, was such a long-term vision. Like I get people asking still, like, how do you make money from the podcast? Like, why are you doing this? And people just don't understand, you know, straight away it's just like money, 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 money. And you got to take off those blinders and think a little bit wider on what's the actual vision on why you're actually doing this. Because let me tell you guys, especially business is hard. Property development is hard, right? It's easier to give up and it's easier to do the things that, what's easy to do is easy not to do, right? And it's easier to just give up and throw in the towel. But if your vision is big enough and the reason why is big enough, like Shannon and Carson's vision was massive and what they're doing now is unreal. But the thing is, they're still the same humble people that they were before. Nothing's changed. And in this industry, I've seen people, I call it the pigeon chest, right? Where you're a developer and then all of a sudden you're doing this and you're doing that. And like the ego in this industry is on another level, right? And you got to make sure that you keep that in check, because in my opinion, if you're good at one thing, stick to that thing, right? And keep squeezing keep squeezing that juice out of that lemon, because what happens is as soon as you start, the ego starts to get involved a little bit, and you get to that next level and that next level and that next level, you're starting, most people are now starting to do it for others, not for themselves and their vision. And you would see this over
It's a really slippery slope.
Yeah.
And if you look at, there's certainly, whether you're an agency or whether you're in your development, the reward at the end, so you go, righto, well, I'm being appointed on this. Wow, look at how much, we don't think about that at all. And I'll guarantee you, if these guys buy a site, they look at the process to get to a point.
Yeah.
Delivery or sale or whatever it is, it's about that process and the disciplines you have in that process. If you're looking at saying, we're going to make this much out of the end of it, and that's your focus, it's a disaster. Mm-hmm. You've got to have an idea of where you're headed, but it's the process that gets you there. Yeah. So, and having, trying to bank that too early in your own mind, so dangerous.
Yeah.
It was interesting. You probably won't remember it, but when we went that auction rooms where we bought Belamble Heights, we ended up buying it off you after the auction. But you said something to me which stuck with me. You're like, I got a lot of respect for developers. He goes, they've got to know a little bit about everything. It's like, you got to understand finance, you got to understand accounting, you got to understand like your raw numbers and the actual art of development and negotiation, and you got to have some people skills. Like, so I guess back to your point before as well, creating those key people around you, having a good lawyer and accountant together, understanding, like, that's probably the biggest weakness of mine, but it's not good enough. You've got to have it's not an excuse where you can just say, well, I don't do the books. So, and you know, you've got to have an understanding, or at least know enough to ask the right questions, you know, and having that good planning, engineering, like they're our two key people, like you mentioned before, like they're our go-to guys before we go anywhere else, unless there's like major ecology issues as well. And I might go that way first, but having that really good core team of people, you know, just little things like paying them straight away as soon as they give you the invoice. Don't wait till the 30 days. You know, like that builds so much goodwill. They want to do your business with you before anyone else. So those, having a really amazing team and just understanding enough about each part of the development process. Like, we're not experts in any of it, but we don't have to be. We, you know, there's guys and girls that are amazing in all of those things. We just got to, you know, you're just the orchestrator to kind of navigate the whole process. So,
and if you're doing the right thing by them, then you're building trust and you're building loyalty, and they'll stick with you. Like, the consultants are awesome. Like, they are really well educated. They honestly, the good ones look after their clients so well. So they're worth their weight in gold.
100%. You mentioned before some of the areas, you know, the urban sprawl of, you know, heading out west. So what do you think of the key areas? So you said north, so Moreton, there's a fair bit happening around Moreton, obviously Ipswich in Logan. Are they the three key areas? And do you see that area being filled from Ipswich all the way out to Toowoomba? Like, what do you see for that space? I know I was talking to a valuer the other day, and he said, oh, just be careful out, you know, Lockyer, it's where all the develop. He goes, there should be a cemetery out there for the developers that went out there and died. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
That was a like red flag. I'll put that in the memory bank. But what's your thoughts on, you know, particular areas that have probably got more upside?
And I've got rose-coloured glasses on at the moment, right, because the market's so good.
Mm.
And there are areas that we're selling stock in now that were brutally difficult, you know, 10 years ago. Yeah, as you move out, and the areas that are like Walloon, Rosewood, Thaguna, as you push out beyond Ripley, those areas are expensive now.
Mm.
Yeah, so they're good areas, and they've got some really good developers in there that are creating a critical mass and that are bringing consumers to the doorstep. Mm. Then you look at sort of Fernvale, yeah, to Fernvale, and that's nearly done. Mm. Yeah, in terms of, if you said, what have you got in Fernvale? You're buying off a developer now. So they've gone out there, and they've got major issues with sewer, but they'll get them solved and release a whole heap of lots in there. Gatton's a good market. Yeah, it's a really good market. It struggles again with any capacity for sewer. And that should be, yeah, that's an issue that should be solved, because there's quite a bit of land that you could release there and put a lot of housing on ground. Areas like Lowood and Laidley, which have been decimated by investment selling, you know, in the 2006, 2007 sort of market, they're back. You know, those areas are selling pretty well. And they're selling well because they are cheaper land. Mm. Push out to Toowoomba, it's booming. Mm. Toowoomba, you know, I was talking to a group the other day. They've owned the land for a little bit and they're developing now. And I sort of said, well, where are your revenues positioning for a 500 square meter block? And they were saying, oh, we've got 400s, probably 400s, early 400s. So I went, wow. Pardon me, when you bought this, where was your fees at? They said, had a one in front of it for the revenues.
But this is what I mean, what we said earlier, right? Is like there's literally that land bank play where you have to just sit on it as well and working out. Like if that is your plan B or your plan C, if anyone buys a big block of land in those areas and waits 10 years, they'll do okay.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's true.
Like you got to have very, very bad luck or you're buying in a really, really shit area.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's just going to keep pushing west, right? North and west. There's nowhere else to go. Like Canungra is like going to be inner city soon. Like,
yeah. And that's, I mean, obviously they've got a plan on the table at the moment to release. And I couldn't argue with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just get the services in and release the land. Gold Coast has got nothing. No land.
No.
Somehow these guys keep finding land though. I don't know. They find it. The 12-year-old son finds it. You get the, but the scraps are sweet, right? And that's the thing with using those relationships, guys, using guys like Tony, reaching out to Tony. And speaking of that, what's the best way to get in contact with you or your team at Ray White Special Projects?
Just phone or email. Yeah. So there's six salespeople in our crew, four support staff. So the six people are on the tools all the time.
Yeah.
And they're all good people. Yeah. They're good operators.
And again, guys, like if you're watching this and this is adding value, feel free to reach out to Tony and his team. Obviously don't waste their time. Make sure that you're doing your research. You're dealing with a seasoned veteran of over 30 years in this space. He's seen the good, he's seen the bad, he's seen the ugly. And right now he's got his rose colored glasses on, as we probably all do on here. And he's, you know, probably seeing feasibilities at 50% now, because that's where people are actually putting their, no, I'm just joking. But, again, guys, if you've been watching this and you enjoy it and you want to learn more, go to Facebook. We have a free property Facebook group called Unemployable Property. We got Shannon and Carson in there every week. We have people. It's growing by the hundreds every week now. We're very humbled by it. It's an amazing group. You'll be asked a few questions. We're screening the people that are in there just to make sure that they're aligned with our values and our mission here at Unemployable Property. So check that out. And I just want to say thank you again to Tony for driving down from Brisbane. That's never an easy drive, especially to the Gold Coast, when you know you got to go back to Brisbane. That's the problem.
Especially for a take two. So we appreciate it.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Shannon, Carson, thank you very much as usual in what you're doing for the community. And like, subscribe, share, comment. Let us know what you like. Let us know what you don't like. We'll keep continuing bringing experts like Tony on here. We're doing this for you guys and making sure that you guys are using this information to your best ability. So please share, like, subscribe, and we will see you guys on the next one. Thank you.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.